96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM, Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. Your questions or comments, toll free at 855-288-4876. Now, Insight.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM, Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
A name I know and I think you should know too. In 1944, Recy Taylor was a young wife and a mother. She was just walking home from a church service she'd attended in Abbeville, Alabama, when she was abducted by six armed white men, raped and left blindfolded by the side of the road, coming home from church. They threatened to kill her if she ever told anyone.
That's Oprah Winfrey at the Golden Globe Awards on Sunday with an emotional speech about empowering women amid the sexual harassment scandal. As you heard, she mentioned Recy Taylor, the central figure in a little-known black history story. Well, tonight, we talk to the author of a book that tells us that difficult but important story. My guest is Dr. Danielle McGuire, author of The Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. We will tell you we're not going to take a lot of calls tonight because we want you to hear about this story, about this book, and its significance then and now. So, Dr. McGuire, first, thank you so much for spending some time with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me tonight.
Absolutely. Let's get right into this. Who was Recy Taylor? Oprah Winfrey said she died about 2 weeks ago now. Who was she?
That's right. Recy Taylor was born in 1919, sort of in the crucible of this horrible year of racial violence and of black resistance, sort of defined her life, really, because she grew up in Jim Crow, Alabama. She became a sharecropper as an adult. She was one of 16 children born to her mother, many of whom died in childbirth or early in their childhood. And so there were about six siblings that she grew old with. And she was just this extraordinary woman. And we remember her because of what happened to her in 1944, but also because of what she did in response to it. Oprah told a little bit of that story on Sunday. But in September of 1944, she was walking home from a church service, and a carload of white boys, teenagers, literally picked her up off the street, kidnapped her at gunpoint, drove her into the woods, and gang-raped her at gunpoint. They threatened to kill her if she told anyone what happened, but as soon as she could get free, she told her husband, her father, and the local sheriff the details of the assault. Somehow, the Montgomery NAACP heard about what happened, and they promised to send their very best investigator, and that woman was Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks came down to Abbeville, which was her father's ancestral home, so she knew people there. And at great risk to herself, she went to Recy's home. She was actually staying with her father because whites were terrorizing the family. And Rosa Parks took Taylor's testimony. And then she carried it. You know, she secreted it out of Abbeville and carried it back to Montgomery, where she and the city's most militant activists organized the Committee for Equal Justice for Mrs. Recy Taylor. It was what the Chicago Defender called the largest campaign against injustice in more than a decade. And that campaign touched people all around the country and even around the world. And they basically organized to demand justice for Recy Taylor. That's, you know, what put her into history. And that's in many ways what we remember her by. But we really need to think about the fact that it was 1944, decades before the women's movement, before the personal was political, before women took back the night, and before Me Too. There was Recy Taylor unashamedly speaking out against her rapist.
You know, I think that's a critical point. You said unashamedly. This is the Jim Crow South. This is Alabama, a place where even in black communities, obviously because of what happened to her. There are no protections
for the
bodies of black people at that time. I would imagine you spoke to Recy Taylor for this book.
Yeah.
What was she like?
Oh, she was beautiful. She was really beautiful, both inside and outside. She was very gracious. She was funny. She was witty. She loved to sing. She loved to go to church. She was a church-going woman. She really had a very strong faith that carried her through all her hardships. And I think, you know, saved her. And she was very, very gracious to me. You know, I went there as a young white woman who had done her graduate, you know, work on her and on women like her. And, you know, they didn't need to let me into their house. They didn't need to trust me. Maybe they didn't at first. You know, I came in with all of that history attached to me in a way, as a white person, as a white woman, you know, in that history of complicity, of violence and of silence about that kind of terror. And so, you know, I was a little scared when I first met her, just because I worried that I would do more harm or that she wouldn't want to tell me her story, but she did. And she didn't struggle with it. She wanted to tell her story. And every time I was with her in a setting where she told her story, she really wanted to do it. And when I asked her, you know, why did you speak out when there were so many risks in doing so, when they had threatened to kill you? And she said, I didn't believe that I deserved what they did to me. And as a young woman, I was just so inspired and continue to be by that stand, that self-confidence, that self-worth, that self-dignity that she possessed, that enabled her to speak out. That's the kind of woman she was. And I really hope that we can all be inspired by that.
I'm talking to Dr. Danielle McGuire. She is the author of The Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement, From Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. At the center of this book is the story of Recy Taylor, an Alabama woman who was raped by six young men in 1944. Recy Taylor died approximately 2 weeks ago. Dr. McGuire, one of the things that I think is really fascinating is that prior to, like a lot of America, prior to Oprah Winfrey mentioning Recy Taylor's name on Sunday, I had not heard of her. And the image of Rosa Parks was not of this civil rights crusader per se, but a demure older seamstress whose feet were tired and she decided that she wasn't going to stand up on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. Why do you think a lot of people just don't know about Recy Taylor and the true person that Rosa Parks was?
You know, I'm not quite sure because there's some really great historical literature on Rosa Parks, particularly. Jean Theo Harris wrote a great book about Rosa Parks as a rebellious race woman. And that's a really great book. But I think part of it is that, you know, we get really comfortable with accepting women in secondary positions. And we also tend not to think about rape and sexual violence, you know, in the civil rights history profession, that is, as civil rights issues. Even though what could be more important to a person's humanity than to be able to move through the world without being assaulted, without being molested, without being touched improperly? You know, black women's bodily integrity was central to all of the major civil rights struggles. And because I think historians were mostly looking at civic issues, like voting rights or like access to public accommodation, they didn't always look at what ordinary people were complaining about in their everyday lives. And what they were complaining about was their inability to be safe and be secure in their own person, right? And the fact that they were vulnerable in almost every space they went into that they walked through. I mean, and that was totally true of white spaces, but it was sometimes true of black spaces too. And so I think that we just haven't, you know, really paid attention to what black women were testifying about at the time. And that's part of a longer history of silencing black women, I think.
I have about a minute before the break, but how did you find out about this story?
Oh, well, I was doing research and I was reading a pamphlet from the 1950s by an organization called We Charge Genocide. And they accused the United States of committing genocide against African Americans and were petitioning to the United Nations. And the pamphlet was a compendium of crimes committed against African Americans, mainly lynchings and other forms of racial terrorism committed against black men. But there were a few stories in there of violence against black women, and one of them named Recy Taylor. But what was interesting to me was that the listing said that this group had petitioned the governor of Alabama for justice. And I thought, aha, the governor's papers are archived, whereas black women's stories and papers are not. So let me go to Alabama and look in the governor's papers and see if there's anything there about Recy Taylor. And there were four boxes, one with the governor's private investigation, which included all the confessions from the rapists and the county and state's effort to cover up their crimes.
Amazing.
And the other boxes were thousands of petitions and postcards from activists all around the country and the world.
We're going to continue this conversation in just a bit. I do have to take a break. So please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue. On Sirius XM Channel 141, I'm Harold Fisher. Angela Stribling is in for Jeff Brown with the original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR. More of this story about Recy Taylor on the other side of the break.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU, and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about Recy Taylor, a young black woman who in 1944 in Alabama was raped by three young white men, and the investigation and the story of that incident. My guest is Dr. Danielle McGuire, author of The Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. Not taking a lot of phone calls tonight. This is a story that we want you to hear and to absorb and to educate yourself about. I want to continue with Dr. McGuire. I can't imagine, having lived in Alabama myself, you know, going through those archives in Montgomery, in one of the State House buildings, I would imagine, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep. Right next to the Confederacy Museum.
What was it that surprised you most about all of the information that you found? And did you have any difficulty getting that information?
So, you know, very often if I asked archivists about what I was looking for, they didn't know how to help me. And so I think whenever you're looking for marginalized people in the archive, in these formal archives, you kind of have to go at it sideways, hence looking at the governor's papers and not looking for Recy Taylor's papers. What really surprised me, I think, was all these postcards. You know, there were hundreds of them, if not thousands, and they were all banded and stacked up. And, I really didn't want to look at all of them because it was so much work, I'll just be honest. But I knew I had to. And so I looked at every single one, and I started to notice a pattern. I started to notice that I recognized the names from Montgomery as being active in the bus boycott. And I recognized the names on the postcard, people who were active in Birmingham in 1963 and Selma in 1965. And then I looked at where they lived because they put their addresses on the postcard. And you could actually map the Black community, at least the Black activist community in those places. And then I found the postcard with Rosa Parks' signature, multiple postcards from her and her mother, which I thought was just wonderful. And all of a sudden, you could see that the bus boycott, the Birmingham campaign, the Selma struggle had a history. And what it did was it made something that I'd heard in 1998 actually make a lot of sense. In 1998, I heard a radio program called Will the Circle Be Unbroken? It was about veterans of the civil rights struggle, and they were talking about Montgomery. And the Montgomery Advertiser, city editor, said, Gertrude Perkins is the most important woman in the bus boycott, but no one knows who she is. And I didn't know who she was, so I went looking for her in the archives, in microfilm newspapers, really. And I found out that she was a Black woman who in 1949 was kidnapped by the Montgomery police, white police officers, and raped. And local activists rallied to her defense and tried to get the officers fired. Now, when I first found out her story, I didn't know what the newspaper editor meant. Like, you know, it was years before the bus boycott. How did this make any sense? How did she matter to the bus boycott? But when I saw Rosa Parks' signature on Recy Taylor's postcards, and all of the other activists in Montgomery who were active in the bus boycott involved in the Recy Taylor case, that comment that I heard in 1998 made perfect sense to me. And then I could kind of trace a series of rape cases in and around Montgomery and assault on the buses or by police officers on Black women that led to the mobilization and built the infrastructure for the bus boycott.
Amazing. What happened to the six young men involved in this assault against Recy Taylor?
They got away with it. They lived their lives. They never had to pay anything. They didn't have to pay with time in jail. They didn't have to pay any kind of restitution. I mean, they got away with it as they knew they would. You know, what they did to Recy Taylor was part of a systemic and longstanding practice by white men and boys, really, on Black women that was rooted in slavery. And so they set out that night to find a Black woman to kidnap and to rape. That's what they wanted to do, and that's what they did. And there wasn't a white man in the county who sat on the jury who was going to convict them for that, because it's what they were taught to do.
So there was a court. There was a court case.
There were two grand jury hearings, but not an actual trial.
Amazing.
Yeah. But because criminal cases, you know, they couldn't move forward unless there was an indictment in the county, no amount of pressure from outside the state or even from the governor's office would matter. And so as long as those Henry County jurors, all white, all male, wouldn't indict those assailants, they were going to get away with it. And those jurors, you know, they were never going to indict those men.
I'm talking to Dr. Danielle McGuire about the Recy Taylor story, a young Black woman who was raped by six young white men in 1944 in Alabama. She's written a book entitled The Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. Talk to me about Rosa Parks' role as an investigator, because when we hear that term investigator for the NAACP and we compare it to the few images of Rosa Parks that we have, they almost don't match up. But I can't imagine the danger that she was in.
Right.
To look into this story.
Yeah, that's right. Rosa Parks is actually really this incredible and fierce activist. You know, she cut her political teeth defending the Scottsboro Boys in Alabama in 1930s. Her grandfather was a Garveyite. She was raised in a home where she was taught to believe that Black was beautiful and that no one had the right to put their hands on her. In the early 1930s, in the Great Depression, she actually was assaulted by a white man who she called in an essay later Mr. Charlie, who tried to attack her while she was babysitting for a white family. And that was so common during that era. And so Rosa Parks had an experience with racial violence, sexualized violence, but she also had a history in her family and in the people she chose to associate with resistance to that kind of racist violence. And so, you know, she married Raymond Parks. Raymond Parks was a local activist, a part of a militant network of men and women who fought against the Scottsboro case. And then she became involved with E.D. Nixon in Montgomery, and he was the local president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the largest black union in the nation. She was surrounded by militants. and so she did that kind of work. And she joined the NAACP in Montgomery in 1943, and she was immediately elected secretary. Now, we usually think of that in gender terms, like, you know, she answered phones, she filed papers. But at that time, it meant she was a field secretary. And so she had basically garnered a reputation as being someone who could be trusted with delicate information, someone who you could go to talk about racial terrorism, who could help you with that. And so Rosa Parks was dispatched all around the state to document crimes against African Americans, cases of lynching, firebombings, beatings, and specifically rape. So long before she sat down on the bus, she was very actively involved. She was probably more actively involved in politics and resistance movements in Alabama than on almost anybody else.
You published this book in 2011. Rosa
Right.
Parks died in 2005. Did you ever have an opportunity to meet her?
I did not, and I am so heartbroken about that.
What does this say as we look at this through the lens of 2018 and an Oprah Winfrey? Because, again, a lot of people never knew about Recy Taylor before Sunday's Golden Globe Award speech by Oprah. Were you surprised when she mentioned Recy Taylor on Sunday?
Absolutely shocked. Absolutely shocked. But, you know, in retrospect, not surprised, just because I think Taylor's story is so inspiring and also so timely in a way. You know, we're going through this reckoning right now. I hope that's what it is. But it's so important that women like Recy Taylor, working class, African American, not able to access, you know, the tools of justice. We still don't have the kinds of justice that marginalized women like Recy Taylor need. And those women are still the most vulnerable to this kind of violence and other kinds of violence. And they're the least likely to be protected. And so Taylor's story resonates in lots of ways, I think. And I know some people are having some feelings about Oprah being the one to tell us about her in the context of the Golden Globe, but I really believe that people in positions of power and privilege need to create space for and to demand justice for the most vulnerable among us, because until they get the same kind of protections that the most powerful people do, then none of us are safe.
I think the optics, as you just described, are interesting, because when you're talking about women and the, you know, as an underclass, as, you know, as underserved and poorly treated by men of power, by a system of power, and then you have arguably the most powerful black woman in the world,
yeah.
Essentially, speaking out about that, I think the optics are really fascinating, because some would argue that we've come so far. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's important to know how far we've come, right? This is not Jim Crow Alabama, although we have a racist president who governs through white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
But we have come far, and that's important. But we still have a long ways to go, and you know, that's important too. And so I think, you know, Oprah Winfrey really, I think, did this remarkable thing in that she, from the very beginning, you know, spoke about the exclusivity, the white exclusivity of Hollywood by talking about being the first Black woman to receive this award, and about, as a Black girl, seeing Sidney Poitier win his award for the first time and what that meant to her. And she talked about that in the context of her mother being a domestic worker, cleaning other people's homes. And so she spoke about that long journey, about her trajectory. But by calling out Recy Taylor's name and linking it to women who maybe are farm workers or continue to be domestic workers, hotel workers, or even women in pink collar or professional positions, she talked about how there's still work to be done, right? But I thought it was really interesting the way in which she really asked us to focus on the most vulnerable women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really important.
Indeed so. I need to take a break. When we come back, I want to continue this conversation and your thoughts about what your role is in writing this book, you know, as a white woman. Certainly the optics there are thought-provoking and interesting, and I'd like to get your response on the other side of this break. And also, where do we go from here, Dr. McGuire? Interested about hearing from you as far as that is concerned as well. So please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about Recy Taylor, a young Black woman who was raped by six young white men in Alabama in 1944. My guest is Dr. Danielle McGuire, author of the book, The Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power. As I said before the break, Dr. McGuire, some would say, you know, here's a white woman who is really digging up those dry bones of the civil rights movement and civil rights horror. Why are you interested in that? What is it that pushed you toward this kind of research and book writing?
You know, when I was in college, I took a civil rights history course, and I was just kind of blown away by it. I hated history until that class, and for some reason, it just sort of spoke to me. I like the idea of people tearing down oppressive systems. I like the idea of ordinary people acting against injustice, and our professor actually took us to Mississippi to do archival work and to meet with veterans of the movement, and so for the first time in my life, the past became a real place with real people in it, and that was kind of magical and life changing. But I was interested in sexual violence, and I was interested in civil rights, and so I combined the two in my research. But you know, I also recognize the history of white people appropriating Black history, appropriating Black culture, and I guess I try to do the work, number one, the deep archival, slow, kind of painstaking patient recovery work, without ever trying to assert this is my story or my history. But I also know that as a white woman, I have privilege in society, and I try to use my privilege to tell the truth about the past, to to unearth stories of white supremacy and white terror so that we can be honest about our history and work to build a new country, build a new present that isn't grounded in white supremacy. I try to use it to educate the people around me, you know, my cousins, so to speak. And I also try to use the privilege I have to create opportunities for the people I know who might not have it otherwise. And I think in some ways that's carrying on the work of, you know, to the best of my ability, of some of those civil rights activists.
That's an amazing self-awareness, no matter what your skin color is, but to realize, you know, what advantages you may have for the advancement of education, for justice, for knowledge. And so certainly I personally salute you for that. I believe that was certainly well said.
Thank you. I have good teachers.
What else is in the book? Obviously, this book isn't just about Recy Taylor and Rosa Parks, obviously kind of a launching pad for broader issues. What else? Give me a nugget from the book as you talk about, you know, part of this title, The Rise of Black Power.
Sure. So basically, I started in 1944 with Recy Taylor, and I finished with the story of Joanne Little. In 1974, Joanne Little, who was an inmate in the Washington, North Carolina jail, she was kind of a petty thief who got thrown in jail, was attacked by the jailer. The jailer was a white man in his 60s who snuck into her cell one night with an ice pick. And she was a very small woman, you know, maybe 5'2", 90 pounds. And he tried to attack her, and somehow she got the ice pick away from him. And she stabbed him to death. And then she escaped. North Carolina put her on trial for murder. But both the women's movement and the Black Power movement rallied to her defense, including Rosa Parks, who led the Detroit chapter of the Free Joanne Little campaign, which, you know, connects back to her 1944 involvement with Recy Taylor and the Scottsboro Boys, just showing her long commitment to anti-rape activism. But basically, the jury had to decide if Black women could be raped, number one, and two, could defend themselves from a sexual attack. Did they have that right? And the civil rights movement, and I think the women's movement, had created the mechanisms for both Blacks and whites to be on the jury and men and women to be on the jury. So she had a jury pool that was more diverse. And basically the jury said, you know what? Black women do have a right to self-defense, and they acquitted her of murder. And this was just a tremendous case. Of course, as we know, the ending isn't happy because we still have Black women who are being raped and brown women who are being raped and women of every color who are being assaulted. It wasn't the end of rape, but it marked a trajectory from slavery, where assaults on Black women and Black women's bodies was, you know, part of the everyday systematic terror, to 1974, where a Black woman could actually murder a white man for raping her and be acquitted because it was self-defense. And that's change. And that change is really rooted in Black women's, you know, tradition of testimony and protest, beginning with enslaved women themselves, like Celia and Harriet Jacobs, and moving through Ida B. Wells and Black club women who spoke out against sexual violence during the nadir, the lynching period, and to Recy Taylor, through other women all the way up to Joanne Little, and now to Anita Hill and Tarana Burke and many more.
That's where I was going next.
Yeah.
With the Me Too movement, in your opinion, is what's happening in 2017 and now 2018 a reckoning on this issue of assault on womankind as we move forward?
I hope it is. I do think that there's still not enough attention paid to the most vulnerable women. And I think that's part of what the Time's Up, you know, campaign that the Golden Globes is about, you know, by actresses bringing in activists who worked in communities and organizations on behalf of the most marginalized women and people. That was bringing greater awareness to the work that they've been doing. But I don't think that Black and brown women, transgender people, queer people, you know, and children, still don't get the kind of justice that they deserve, and they're still really vulnerable to attack. And so that's where the work needs to be done, and we all have a responsibility to do that work in our communities.
It's interesting because I also was keenly aware of what Oprah and others said on Sunday about men who are willing to listen. Right. Is this also a partnership?
I hope it is. I don't think we can do this without men. You know, it can't just be about the survivors. It has to be about the perpetrators. And I think it's important for men to listen and understand women's experiences and their pain and what they've had to endure and put up with. But I also think it's really important for men to speak out. And by that, I mean men speaking out against bad behavior and other men who are participating in and continuing a culture and practices that demean women, that turn them into things that should be used and abused, and objectify them.
Have you heard from Oprah since Sunday?
I have not. No, I have not heard from Oprah, but I'll give her my number.
I would not be, you know, surprised if, you know, if down the road, a short road, that you do hear from her. This book is a fascinating treatise on so many critical issues that are happening right now, even with the in-depth research and the history that you've provided. It's very, very timely, and it's just amazing that it's published in 2011 and now 2018. I'm sure you're getting all kinds of inquiries now.
Yeah, it's very strange. But I'm grateful for it, and I know for a fact that Recy Taylor's family is just really proud of the impact that her story has had on so many people.
When was the last time you spoke to her?
Oh, well, probably a few months ago. I just went to her homegoing on last Friday, and so I saw the whole family there. And, of course, none of us expected Oprah to call her name on Sunday, but it seemed like a fitting send-off for the weekend, which began on Thursday with her wake and Friday with the homegoing.
Yes, indeed. I only have about a minute or so left. I'm looking at some information about you. You're working on yet another book about a critical time in the near the end of the civil rights movement, the Algiers Motel murders. Are you still working on that?
I am. I'm still working on that. I'm writing a book about that and about the long history of police violence in Detroit against African-Americans. And I've gotten to know all the survivors of the violence that night at the Algiers. That's what the movie Detroit was based upon and what John Hershey's book in 1968 was based upon. And I have to say, like, that kind of trauma it's something that still needs to be talked about. I think the survivors of the police attack on people in the Algiers Motel during the 1967 Detroit uprising, including the killing of three young Black teenagers, left scars on the survivors that they have to this day. Real post-traumatic stress. And in our conversations about police violence, I think it's really important that we talk about the way in which that violence resonates over time and over generations.
Another very pertinent and timely topic. And so, again, you know, I certainly salute the work that you're doing and, you know, the research and the stories that you're telling. For those who want more information about you, how can they find you on the web?
They can find me at DanielleMcGuire.com or DMcGuire13 on Twitter. And I'm on Facebook, and you can Google me.
Okay, there you go. Dr. Danielle McGuire, again, we salute your work. Thank you so much for sharing with us. And
you're welcome.
And good luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Thursday, December 11th, 2018. I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now, stay tuned for The Connection with Lorna Newton. Good night.